Okay, so we are now recording. So yes, Alan will lead us through the deck. Before we get to that, I just wanted to ask if anybody is joining us because of seeing about us in Meetup, please let us know. You could either do it audibly or just throw it into the chat. Just say, yes, I came from Meetup. We just want to know whether this is something that is going to be of value to the group or not. So again, a reminder that we are doing an audio recording, which will be made available afterwards along with the deck. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan. And Alan, are you muted? Yes, you are muted.
So there we go. You've got the title slide on the screen.
Yep.
Okay, good enough. All right, first thing off, the web survey about the technical sessions produced a number of suggestions, and here they are, or those plus one other. And we're looking for somebody who would like to make some presentations on one or more of the above. So one is about scanners, and another one is on these electronic assistants, Alexa or Google Assistant. How to choose security software for your computer and smartphone, and the different kinds of USB ports. So if any of those you think you would like to contribute one of our shares, please send us a note to the suggestions box. Okay, first thing off, another suggestion came in to say that we don't have an index to the topics in our question and answer sessions, the recordings especially. So one has now been produced. And if you look at the link here, our website, QA Topics, that will take you to a page which has got the index of the various topics. Until Google sends around its bots and scans the site, you won't be able to search in Google for the various topics, but that will come eventually. In the meantime, if you go to something like Edit, Find in this page in your web browser, or use Control F to pop up the search box, you can enter some text, and then it will look for your keyword on that page. And after that, everything is referenced to a date of a meeting. And then if you go to the recordings page, you can look at the various files that are there, the PowerPoint deck, the chat window, and the audio recording files. And that will give you the information that you're interested in. Okay, the next thing we have is a share, and this one is from Chris.
Yeah, okay. I just came across this. I thought it might be of interest to some people. 20 years ago, the love bug virus hit, which was rather unique at the time in that it really didn't try to exploit the computer, but it exploited the person in front of the computer. And it tried to trick people into opening an email. And if they did and they opened the attachment, it would spread to everybody who was in their Outlook contact list. And so for a long time, it was really unknown. Well, we knew who the person was, but they weren't charged because it was in the Philippines and there was no law against computer hacking at that time. And so somebody actually tracked him down over the years and came up with a little bit of story that was in Wired magazine. And so if you're interested in a little bit of the story behind the love bug virus, the URL is on the screen, and I will get that pasted into the chat as well.
Okay. And for those of you who are members and have looked at the member forum on the web, you will have seen this posting from Chris a few days ago that Microsoft has released the fall update, the so-called October 2020 update, version 20H2, now available for people who are running 1903 or later.
I can report that I did a seek on that today, and one of my three computers got the update. It went in less than 10 minutes from the time it started downloading until the time it was rebooted and into 20H2. The other two computers, I did a seek on those, and it was not offered to either of them.
Okay. And there have been a review of the update in PC World. Mark Hackman says, all in all, it's another in the line of anemic fall feature updates. So that's what you have to look forward to. As Chris said, some of us have received the update. It came to me as an optional update. But since I'm a first responder or a first adapter or something, I thought I would, like Chris, I'd install it and see what happened. I did better than you, Chris. It took 3 minutes on my machine to download, install, reboot, and get the system back up and running.
Wow, that's impressive.
And you can have a little look and see what's new in the update feature. And there's a whole raft of stuff. Millions of tips, more than I can count on one hand. So I looked at this first one, which is this what's new. There are 12 different tips there. And the very first one says that there's a nice colorful interface on your start menu. And now you can choose between a light mode on the left and a dark mode on the right. So there are some things in that update, even though it seems to be a fairly lightweight kind of option. Anyway, coming to a computer near you fairly soon, I imagine. Moving along, our first real question of the night. This is basically following up on my presentation at the club meeting on managing Android phones. And this individual has a phone that's stuck at version 7, which is Android Nougat. I've installed malware security software, but how much is that going to do for me if I'm stuck with this old version of the operating system? So I had a look on the web to see what happens when you get stuck in the old version, and almost everything recently that's been published refers back to this article in Which, and Which is, for those of you who don't know, is a UK publication. It's like the Consumer Reports. So, you know, which is the best vacuum cleaner, which is the best laptop computer, that kind of thing. Been around for decades. And this particular article is really interesting. I recommend it as a good read. It just reflects all of the things that I said about how I was unhappy that Android operating system has a very limited, and smartphones. When you pay hundreds of dollars for a smartphone, you end up with an operating system that has a very limited shelf life. And basically their argument was that the government, i.e. the UK government, should regulate this and put Android out of business or get them real or something. But they point out that because the Android operating system just basically dies in terms of updates, almost 40% of people who are using Android, that would be phones and tablets, are no longer receiving security updates and so are at risk. And that's a billion Android devices across the planet, as it were. So that's a lot of people basically at risk. And they also have a bunch of suggested countermeasures, but it's kind of what we all know. You know, be careful what you download, be careful what you click on, make sure that you have a backup of your data, and use an antivirus on your mobile device, which was essentially the question, how good is it? Well, it's better than nothing, I guess, is the answer. We've been using antivirus on computers for years, and most of us have not experienced any problems with that. I have no reason to believe that having a reasonable antivirus program on a phone would be any different. So you should get decent protection by doing that. Another article on the web was more general, and it talked about how to check your security, and as it says, 16 steps to a safer phone. And again, a lot of the stuff was fairly common sense, but they included things like, take a look at the apps that you have installed on your computer. Do you need them all? Are they all secure? Are their preferences and passwords appropriate for the system? Check the various security settings and so on and so forth. So if you're interested in doing a pretty detailed checkup on your Android device, that's a pretty good reference in terms of all the things that you can do. Okay, moving along. The second question that came in was, I think this is Natalie, who's been transferring pictures from the cell phone and a digital camera to the computer. And even though they're set to be at a low resolution, the lowest resolution available, the resulting files she finds are way too big. And I know Chris has some thoughts on this, and I think you want to do a share screen.
Yeah, I got to, sorry, I should have done shift 5. Okay, I wanted to do the sharing of the screen from my computer just because there are some build slides, and rather than everybody having to listen to next, I'll go through it. So most photos that are on cameras, camera phones, are in JPEG format. Now, there are some camera apps that can record in RAW format, but for the most part, the built-in cameras apps that are on phones will always be saving in JPEG format. There's really two ways that you can make those images smaller than their native full res. You can either reduce the resolution or you could reduce the quality. So reduction in resolution is actually the most straightforward. So an example would be if you have a camera that takes pictures 6,000 by 4,000 pixels, it's a 24 megapixel photo. And so it's typically will be about 20 megabytes in file size. So they are sizable images. So if you wanted to reduce the resolution, say in both dimensions to 1920 by 1080 or a maximum of 1920 and a maximum of 1280, it brings it down to about 2 megapixels. And it's under 2 megabytes in file size. Now, the reason why I picked 1920 by 1280, I'll talk more about that later on, but that's a standard high-def screen. So if you're going to be displaying things on screen or sending it to somebody and all they're going to be doing is looking at it on screen, there's rarely a point where having something bigger than 1920 by 1280, or that should be 1080, is going to make any sense at all. So the result of that reduction in resolution alone, you get down to under one-tenth the file size on disk. You will get a reduction in fine details, but only if you view the original photo at one-to-one pixels or higher resolution than your 1920 by 1080. So it is most appropriate for display on screen at 1920 by 1080. But what about if you have higher resolution screen, like a 4K monitor? And this starts to come into play if you're emailing it or sending it to somebody else. You don't necessarily know what their maximum resolution screen is. So if you don't know, you might go to something bigger than 1920 by 1080. But for all intents and purposes, most people, I think, if you send 1920 by 1080, that's plenty of resolution for them to view it, and you will not see any reduction in fine details. It is not appropriate for printing. So if you're ever going to want to print this, the printer resolution is always going to be much higher than that. And so reducing it is, you are definitely going to end up losing those fine details. So the other way to do it is through JPEG quality setting. So whenever you save a JPEG file, you can save not only resolution, you can also tell it a quality setting. And the idea behind this, and this is an oversimplification by far, but it gives you the idea of what's going on in the background. The idea of JPEG quality, you don't have to store the data about every pixel that is in the image. So if you have, for example, 1,000 pixels in one area of the image that are almost the same, brightness and color, what if instead of storing each of those 1,000 pixels, you just say, Well, we'll call them all one brightness and color, and we'll say do it 1,000 times. The results of that is that you get significant file size reduction, and you will get a reduction in quality ranging from imperceptible to very significant. So what is the definition of almost the same brightness or color? So JPEG quality settings always range from 1 to 100, and normally the best quality is 90. Now, this can vary by whatever program you're using to actually save the JPEG file, but as a general rule, 90 will give you basically no reduction in the quality of the image that is perceptible. If you make it higher than 90, typically what you do is you don't improve the quality, but you do increase the file size on disk. So generally speaking, leave it at 90 if you want it to be the best quality that you can get. So if you store it at best quality, you will get more colors and brightness levels that are considered to be unique and stored individually. And consequently, you will get less reduction in the file size. You'll still get some reduction in file size, but less so. If you go to a lower quality, so somewhere between 1 and 89, more of those colors and brightness levels will be considered to be the same, and therefore will be reducing the quality of the image, and we'll see an example of it in a minute. You'll get more reduction in file size, and the smaller the quality setting is, the more reduction you'll get, and consequently more loss in detail in the image. So these images that I'm bringing up, they're not scaled accurately. It just gives you a bit of an idea. So if we have here an original 8 megabyte or megapixel, that should be 8 megapixel file. Sorry, it is 8 megabytes. And so we look at that and we see the quality. If we reduce that, the original has already been compressed to fit that, to fit the screen. And you can see that inset shows you a one-to-one representation of that particular portion of the photo. And you can see that the fine detail has been lost in the larger image. Now, if you reduce that down to 1920 by 1223, which is basically saying reduce it to a maximum of 1920 on the horizontal, and it just came out at 1223 on the vertical. It reduced it from 8 megabytes down to 500 kilobytes. So significant reduction. Because the original was already compressed down to fit the screen, they're both looking very, very good, and they're extremely similar in the way that they get presented on screen. And we end up with a file size that is 1/16th the original, which is pretty significant reduction. So if we take that reduced file, 1920 by 1223 pixel image at 500 kilobyte, and instead we reduce it down to something that is smaller, so 640 by 408 pixel image. And because it is smaller than the screen, normally most image viewers will just leave it smaller size. You can get image viewers that will actually scale it up. If they do scale it up, you will be losing quality. But normally it'll end up being less smaller. And now we're down to a size of 1/93rd of the original size, down to 86 kilobytes. So really significant and still good quality, but a smaller image. Let's go back to our 1920 by 1223 pixel image, 500 kilobyte. And if we go to a quality of 50, okay, on that 1 to 100 scale, it reduces that 500 kilobyte image down to 150 kilobyte. And quite frankly, I look at that and I think it's pretty hard to distinguish that there is any loss in quality or a significant loss in quality. If you really pixel peep at it and really look at fine details, you can probably find some areas where, yes, the above image looks a little bit better than the bottom one, but quite frankly, it's not bad. And that's 1/53rd of our original file size that we're down to at 150 kilobyte. Let's look at an extreme example if we reduce it down to quality of 1. Okay. At that point, it is throwing away lots of data. So if you look at the grays in the background where the rocks are, you can see that really in our gray color, we've got about 5 brightness levels, and that's it. And it looks like each of the color channels is probably 5 or 6 levels of brightness that it's actually doing. And so by equating out things and saying, well, these are all, you know, it's 50 to 60 brightness level, or, you know, they normally runs from 0 to 255. And so it's probably chunks of about 50 brightness levels that are all being considered now the same. Okay, so very poor quality, but it's down to 18 kilobytes, so 1/444th of the original file size. I don't think anybody would find that useful, but it gives you a little bit of an idea how things work. So some considerations. You know, are you going to crop the image? Are you interested in only the full image, or are you going to be cropping in on it? If you're going to be cropping in on it, you don't want to be throwing away too much detail in your image before you crop. Are you going to be printing it? If you're going to be printing it, you want to have the maximum resolution available. You want to look to the maximum resolution of wherever you're going to display that particular image, and scale it down to that is probably what you want to do if you want to maximize the disk savings. And do you care about the quality? Some people, if you're very protective of your photos, you may actually want a reduction in the quality before you send it on to somebody else. If you care about, you know, somebody stealing your photos or something like that, maybe you actually want lower quality. Now, if you're editing, if you always save at a quality level of 90, you can repeatedly open that file, edit it, save it at 90, edit it the next day, save it, open it up again, edit it again. You can repeatedly re-edit that, and you won't lose significant quality. If you are saving at a lower quality setting, every time you save it, more details are going to get lost. Okay, so keep that in mind if you're doing multiple re-edits on a photo. I would do it, save it at the 90 level until such time as you're at your end, and then if you want, save it at a lower quality. Keep in mind, once you discard that detail, you can't get it back unless you have your original image that you can go back to. So just keep that in mind. And I think that is it. So I will let Alan take over again.
Okay, a couple of things in the chat from Tom. One thing he says is reducing JPEG sizes, use riotoptimizer.com. which is also available as a plugin in UrfanView. And for no loss, use PNG or TIFF formats. Okay, so are we back to my screen now?
Yes, we are.
Okay. All right, so
Regarding the Riot, you can actually specify a target file size or actually adjust all of the parameters of JPEG to reduce the size to arbitrarily to whatever size you want or whatever quality you want, and it allows you to compare.
Now you just ask about a batch resizer. Are there any that would detect pictures that are either landscape or portrait, and I wouldn't have to adjust the height and width?
UrfanView can do that. It has a batch resizing, and in it you can specify a maximum dimensions, either horizontally or vertically or both. And it'll go through all of them. And you can also say, don't make anything smaller. Don't upscale anything that is smaller. So there's a lot of capabilities in UrfanView for being able to do batch conversions like that.
And I use FastStone Image Viewer, which has a similar capability. You can tell it to ignore whether it's landscape or portrait and just size everything based on the longest side.
UrfanView also gives you the ability to just specify a percentage. You want it 50% or 60%.
Yeah.
And I think FastStone does the same thing. You can do it in pixels, percentage, inches, whatever you want.
Thanks.
Also, I sent an email to the suggestion thing with a variety of suggestions for reducing the sizes of files. I think the first two are getting a big external hard drive. If you're running out of space, they're fairly cheap these days. And the second one is you can go through all your photos and actually delete the ones that you don't want. And this is a good opportunity to send them off to the people in the photos or put them up on a blog or whatever you do with them. But that, I think, is the best way to reduce the size of things is to eliminate them completely. And I have a bunch of other ideas that are generic for reducing sizes of files or the size of data on your hard drive that I can go through if you want.
Well, Tom, you had a ton of ideas in there, and I think Alan replied back to you and CC'd me on it, that I think what we might do is next week or a future Q&A anyways, talk more generically about, the ultimate guide to reducing the footprint on your devices. And so how to deal with that. And there are a lot of good ideas in there, and I think we can probably come up with some more as well and sort of try to come up with an all-encompassing thing that people can go through the list and see what's appropriate for them and what isn't.
Oh, sure.
And I like the idea of buying the biggest hard drive you can find and just dumping everything onto it. So by the time you need another one, it'll be twice as big for half the price. Okay, the next question that came in is kind of a follow-up to outdated Android operating systems. And what do I do with a Chromebook that's too old to receive updates? But otherwise, it's working really well. Well, I don't have a Chromebook, but I took a little look at this on the web, and it turns out that in 2016, Google introduced their end-of-life policy, and that gave Chromebooks a support period of 5 years. And then a year later, they made a major change and changed the name from end of life to auto update expiration. But they extended the support period to 6.5 years. That information came from the Guardian in 2019. So their end of life policies, whatever you want to call it, are better for Chromebooks than they are for Android smartphones. But they're still limited, and more limited, I think, than Windows computers, for example. So what can you do? Well, as far as I can see, there's basically three things you can do. As with Android, you can basically do nothing, use the device as it is, but take as many security precautions as you can in terms of antivirus software and being careful how you actually use the machine in terms of accessing the internet and downloading software and that kind of thing. Now, the second thing is to have a look at the actual device and decide, well, it's 6.5 years old or more. It's probably not the most powerful computer in the world. And are you finding it relatively slow? And if so, maybe it's time to just bite the bullet. Chromebooks are relatively inexpensive computers, so maybe you could consider just buying a new, more up-to-date Chromebook and get higher performance at still reasonable cost. And then the third one, which I really like, is just install a completely different operating system. And there's a number of options for that. And one of them is to use what you might think of as a clone, the Chromium operating system. There's a company called Neverware that produces something called Cloud Ready, and that is a replacement operating system for the Chromebook. And the Home Edition is a free option, so that's a possibility if you're into changing operating systems. The second thing, which is more on my line, and Chromium's really built on Linux, so that's why you can install Linux applications on some Chromebooks. But it also means that the hardware will support Linux distros, so How to Geek has a number of suggestions in terms of how you might install a Linux distribution instead of the Chromium OS. And now you're in the situation where you'd have an up-to-date operating system which would be receiving regular updates itself. PC Magazine says basically the same thing. It talks about installing an Ubuntu desktop, Ubuntu Linux desktop, alongside Chrome, with an unofficial environment called Crouton, which I know nothing about. And it also says you can install Linux in a more traditional fashion, i.e. by dual booting it in a separate partition, and they suggest using the Gallium Linux operating system for that. So those are a bunch of options that if you have an old Chromebook, those are some of the things that you can do with it. As I say, I don't have any Chromebooks, so I don't know whether those are good, bad, or indifferent options. Okay. Our next question, I forget who it came from now, but they downloaded Microsoft Teams into a laptop and then found that the image, the logo for the owner of the computer had changed. It used to be an outline and now it's completely filled in. So Chris has some ideas about that.
Yeah, it's just that that comes from in the settings app. So if you go to settings, accounts, your info, on the right-hand side, you'll see that there's a create your picture. And you can either have it turn on your camera if you've got a camera on your computer, or you can select it from a digital image that you have on your computer. And that will replace that empty avatar on the login screen with whatever you choose.
Yes, hello, this is Ollie, but I didn't touch anything. It changed by itself. That was, and it was also had kind of fuzzy line, and it happened right after I downloaded this large file. So that's why I was curious. I didn't intentionally change it.
No, but I wouldn't worry about it.
No,
that is just I'm sure it's just an oddity of Windows that for some reason it decided. I can't see any malicious act that would specifically target your profile picture on the login screen.
No, somebody just suggested it was a ghost.
Yeah. Yeah, ghost called Microsoft Windows.
this image is actually my log-on screen, and I've updated Windows a number of times, and it doesn't affect the pussycat there, so she's happy.
The fact that you're going to toast your pussycat, though, I don't know.
Oh, well, you know my theory. Well, it's my buddy's theory about toast is that computers should be simple and you should just plug them in and they should just work.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my computers all get called toaster because of that. There's a comment in the chat here, or a question, I guess. Is the chat, the contents of the chat window saved with the recording? There are some good links provided. I'm just wondering if I need to make a screenshot before signing out. No, you don't need to do that. The slides are saved as a PDF file. The audio recording is saved as an M4A, I think it is, a sound file. And the contents of the chat window get saved as a text file. And those are all posted to the QA recordings page on the club's website. So they will be available. Okay. Another question that came in was that Ontario is working on a digital wallet, and that's going to allow people to carry identification like birth certificates, driver licenses, around in digital form. The question is, does that mean that current IDs are going to be consolidated into a single ID card, perhaps with a user login and password? Or is the government considering biometric authentication? And he's concerned about biometrics because the ID might get hacked. I hadn't heard about this, but if you go to the Ontario government's website and look at their newsroom, you'll find that there is indeed a digital identity project. And it's exactly as said, that you'll be able to have a digital identity on a mobile device, and then you'll be able to access services by using essentially a smartphone rather than carrying multiple kinds of IDs with you. So the way it works, or the way it will work, if it is established, first of all, they'll establish a digital identity by verifying a number of aspects of your actual identity. So you'll have to provide, you know, a driver's license, a passport, a secured health card, that kind of thing. And once they have identified that you are you, then you'll receive a digital ID. Everything is going to happen on a mobile device, so typically a smartphone. And then the digital documents, basically copies of your driver's license, copies of your passport, that kind of thing, will be saved in this digital wallet. And then you'll be able to use that, and that will help, they say, provide or help to combat identity fraud and protect your data. And you won't have to scan a document and send it through email, for example, to for some government purpose or whatever. The data that you provide to the digital wallet will be encrypted. It'll be strong encryption and privacy protected. So things like names and dates of birth and your address and your social security number will all be encrypted on the mobile device, and hence should be pretty secure. Two provinces already doing this, BC and Alberta, and they have both integrated their digital ID systems with the feds. So their residents can now access federal services as well as provincial ones using these provincial digital ID systems. The news release from Ontario says that starting in January, they will be consulting with industry as to how they can introduce this secure digital identity system, and they're looking at the end of 2021. Now, it turns out that they've already given out a contract, $1.2 million, to this Ottawa company called Blue Ink Limited, and they have developed something called EIDME. And if you go to their website, and there are a number of different video demonstrations as to how they might do this. And basically what they do is you take a selfie of yourself on your phone from a couple of different angles, which gives them a kind of a baseline profile. You then scan things like your driver's license and your passport and that kind of thing, and they compare the digital photograph on the ID to the selfie photographs, and look up numbers in databases, I guess. And basically, they ensure that you are you. And then once they've decided that, then they give you a digital ID. The company deletes all the registration information off their server, and your digital ID on your cell phone now lets you access all these different government services. So that's how it's supposed to work. They don't talk about using fingerprints and retina scans and that kind of thing. Although they do mention that on the website, they do mention that fingerprints are a personal identifier. So conceivably, biometrics could be a part of this process. It's just that they don't say so specifically at the moment.
And what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, precisely. But it is securely encrypted. So you have your password manager on your phone securely encrypted, so you obviously believe it's true. Why wouldn't Ontario? Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting proposition, but maybe it's the wave of the future. Who knows? A question came up about running a PC with dual monitors. This is Bob Harris. His second monitor sometimes doesn't wake up after going to sleep. And he found that by unplugging the power cord and plugging it back in again, that generally brought the second monitor to life. However, he's recently bought a brand new laptop and plugged in the same monitors, and now playing around with the power cords and the data cable doesn't always work for him. So Chris had a number of suggestions.
Yeah, I looked up some information on this, and I was surprised to find out that this doesn't seem to be all that uncommon a problem. So I was specifically looking in the idea of a dual monitor situation, and I ran across a number of suggestions, BIOS changes, updating video drivers and things like that. A couple of the ones that sort of looked interesting was the keystroke Control-Shift-Windows-B. And it says here, restarts the graphics driver. It doesn't really, but it's essentially that. And so that could kickstart the signal to that secondary monitor. And the other one of making sure you kickstart that secondary monitor is going into using WinP, which brings up the presentation mode where you can select whether you want your output to go to just the main screen, your external screen, or duplicate or extend if you're using the external monitor. And so by just going in, doing WinP, select duplicate, and then immediately press extend, which presumably you're in that mode normally, that worked for some people that had this problem where the secondary monitor wouldn't wake up. So there are a number of other suggestions that were in there as well, but those are the ones that seem to be the most likely to help. Unfortunately, with Bob, it doesn't seem that these are actually solving the problem for him.
But his new solution is just to buy a great big monitor and use that, a brand new monitor. So that would work really well.
That's right.
No, it was very helpful, Chris. I appreciate the great comments. And I have one coming on Friday or Monday, I guess. But that was very helpful. I learned a lot, too. Thank you much.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, now you can have three monitors.
Possible, yeah.
I have four currently, so including a new big one. But I would suggest one thing, aside from the cords, is to just turn the monitor off and on. Another solution would be to not sleep your computer, but to hibernate, especially if you have a hard drive that you can as your system disk.
I think, Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you're actually sleeping the computer. It was just turning the monitor off after a period of time, right?
Well, I had mine set to sleep in 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And you mentioned about going to hibernation in the BIOS. I didn't get that far. But I'm pretty sure now that it was the power cord issue, because I would jiggle the power cord at the monitor, remove, replace, it would work fine. And I tried it this afternoon, going under my desk, I have a whole complex of wires, and remove, replace the power cord at the power bar end, and then that did nothing, which should have been the same thing at the other end, at the monitor end. And then I realized that there's something in there. If you jiggle a little bit firmly, you can almost lose the whole monitor. So there's a solder connection I might be able to fix myself. New one arrives here.
Yeah, it's probably in your monitor rather than the cord itself. Cords are usually fairly sturdy. You could try replacing the power cord. They're pretty generic.
No, I did that, and thanks so much. I tried that. It worked for 4 days with no problem. I was so proud of that. Anyway, that was short-lived. And anyway, it's a fun procedure. I'll get a bigger monitor soon. And you're right. I had three at work when I was working, but I had three at home. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
You can only use three or four monitors if you have enough video outs on your system. So you need a couple of video cards, maybe.
You're right. Yeah. Yes.
No, you can get these adapters that plug into a USB 2 or 3, And with USB 3, you can get full high definition. And they're like $5 on eBay or your favorite Amazon store. And it's Fresco Baldi or something. I'll put a link in the notes as to the thing, the drivers, and that's what I'm using. I'm using two monitors on two of these USB 3 adapters.
And well, that on that,
Tom, I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, and on that suggestion as well that you're pasting in there, Nat was asking if the chat suggestions topics are included in the index, and I believe currently they are not. However, I wonder, Alan, whether, like, when people just paste in URLs for additional information, would it make sense to add this to the deck before you PDF it and then include that there as well? Or I'm really good at suggesting other people work.
Yeah, just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
I'll take a look at that. I mean, it should be, it'd be easy enough to add it to the list of topics, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, with that, we've gone through all of the deck. So if there's anybody else who has questions or comments, shares of information, now's the time to either unmute yourself and pipe up or throw it into the chat.
I have a question. I was checking my spam from one of my Gmail accounts and saw that someone had sent me this message saying, I know your password is blah, 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 and I have that password for some old sites, and they were threatening me, and, you know, I have to send them blah, 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 you know, via Bitcoin. And I'm just wondering, I'm not sure where the password was taken from, which site was hacked or whatever, but I'm just wondering, can they do anything with that, you know, because it's really just for an old site or, you know, something I don't use. Is there anything I should be leery of? I'm going to see what I've used for that with that password and change them, but just wondering about an immediate sort of concern.
Yeah, there's I'm just checking the URL.
It's in chat
now. Good site to I've been pwned, and I will paste that into the chat is a good resource. And what you can do with this, let me just get this pasted and then I'll talk to it just briefly. Yeah, there we go. So if you go to that site, you can put in your email addresses that you own, and they will notify you if that email address has showed up in any disclosures that came out of hacks or whatever of particular sites. So, for example, Adobe, you know, had 80-odd million email addresses that were disclosed in a hack. And so have I been pwned would let you know that, oh, your email address has now been, you know, publicly made available as part of a hack. And that's a good idea to then go to at least the site where it was hacked from and change it there. If you've happened to use the same password anywhere else, for sure, change it there as well. It's a good idea to keep unique passwords on absolutely every site. It is certainly a best practice. For the email that you received, I would just totally ignore it other than using it as a wake-up call that your email has been somehow leaked as part of a hack. So it was probably one of the websites. It did get your account may have been compromised on that. Now, it might be just disclosure of an email address, but it could be other things depending on the hygiene of the website. Potentially, it could be that the attackers got your password as well. These emails that go out like that are just generic phishing ones trying to make you think that, okay, you are a danger because they know your password. And, well, yeah, if it was just that some hack that you no longer use that account or whatever, is certainly nothing to be worried about.
Okay, so I actually just put my address in and it says, yeah, three breaches. So one is an actual site that I used long ago, but then it lists two other ones and it says collection, I don't know, 2,844 separate data breaches unverified. So I don't know what that means, like in terms of what I should do.
Sense of duplicate because some there's a this guy Troy Hunt does a whole bunch of data sets. And he's got like a billion or 2 billion passwords that have been released in various hacks. And he doesn't store the password, so it doesn't do any good to attack him. Or to actually try to get what the password is, but it identifies where they have been leaked. You can take a look at the website and explore, but sometimes these things come out in more hacks because people have been copying them into things and selling them on the internet. And it's probably a duplicate, in short. In other words, it's a duplicate of the original that you put in.
It's not a bad idea if you think that, and especially if you don't have too many sites to do it, is if you're concerned, just go and change the password and the security questions, at each of the sites that you really frequent. One that you want to make sure that you protect very, very highly is if you use any one particular email address as a recovery address so that you can go to a site, say it's Facebook. And you say, I forgot my password, and you put in your email address, and they email you a link to reset your password. Well, that email address, you want to make sure that that is really, really well protected, preferably with two-factor authentication, because if anybody attacks that and gets a hold of that account, then they can go to places like Facebook and try a password reset, and then they, because they control your email address, they could then go in and reset your password on Facebook or your bank or wherever else you've used that email address as a recovery tool. Any other questions or comments we have?
Chris, it's Karen. Just wondering how you find out the end of life for an Android device. Do they post that, or is it something that's known up front when you buy the device? You can see how long you've got.
We talked a little bit about this last week, and it's a bit of a crapshoot, unfortunately. Android is a bit of a mess, and different manufacturers have different policies. I think if you look at the deck from last and the Q&A probably or the chat from last week, there will be some links in there to some places where you can check. So some manufacturers are better than others about saying what their support policies are. Google is pretty good for their Pixel devices and whatever else it is that they make. Samsung,
Nexus.
Nexus. Samsung has out some information, so there's a site on that, but it really depends on the manufacturer.
That's great. Yeah, I had to cut out before you guys were done last week on the Android stuff, and I haven't had a chance to look at the presentation yet, so thanks. I will.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, another call out to if anybody has joined us tonight from Meetup, please let us know either audibly or in the chat window. Just so we know whether that's working or not. And also, we had a suggestion from Linda that we mentioned that, let me see, I pasted it into the chat. So the topics that Alan mentioned at the start, Alan, do you want to go back to those topics that came out of the questionnaire? Can you jump back to that slide?
Good question. Let me think about that.
Should be number 2, enter, I think, or something like that. If you just hit 1 and enter, it'll jump you back to the front. Anyhow, when he gets that slide up, it's slide number.
Come up.
If you're clicking your deck to make it the active window, and then just hit 6. Oh, there you go.
Oh, I just did.
Okay. So these topics that are coming up that we have here, if you can input to it, that's great. But another option would be if you know somebody else who may be an expert in any of these particular topics, you could invite them to be part of a future Q&A session on that as well. So it doesn't have to be a member. Feel free to invite a family member or friend to participate in it as well. Okay, do we have any other questions, comments, shares?
I'm not sure I'm an expert at this Google or the Amazon Alexa. I'd be curious to know how many users among us have a smart speaker in their house.
Yeah, for
Lawrence, there's Lawrence and Linda.
Yeah, I do.
I have a few. I have 5 or 6.
I think Mr. Bob Walker, I think you have a smart device, don't you?
Yeah, I have a few of the Amazon Echoes. So, but I'm not what you would call a sophisticated user, but Bob Harris and his wife, Debbie, are quite advanced at this, and I've learned a lot of stuff from them.
Well, Debbie does more than I do, and she has lights coming on and off on timers, and I've asked her to do something, but she hasn't, anyway, nothing yet replied. But
we've got Gail, who replied that she has Alexa, Karen has none, Bob somebody has 3, so we're currently at 31, down to 30 people, so there's at least half a dozen of us that, Tom just says 0. I find them actually quite handy. I'm not yet ready yet to turn over my thermostat to something that could be controlled over the internet, but my lights and just being able to query things, I find it very, very handy for sure. Get the weather and get the traffic report, and Tom just says he squeezes his pixel. Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to see how people use those devices. I'd be happy to contribute into that to a couple of bullet points of the sort of things that I do. So if people want to send that into suggestion box at opcug.ca, we could put together a couple of slides of things that people do. Or somebody figures that they do fairly sophisticated things with it, and you wanted to take a few minutes at a Q&A, that would be great as well.
Yeah, they were as cheap as $24 on Prime Day.
Wow.
The third generation dots, and a really good sound. And I find them great for music and radio and Calgary. I listen to our States radio and all over the house.
I like it just for things like finding out when a store opens and things like that is really, really handy.
You're dead right. A quick thought in your head when it opens, and yeah. They've really improved that the last, I'd say, 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Google Assistant does a good job of that, and I prefer to be in control of when it's listening to me, and that's when I squeeze my pixel.
Yeah. Okay, we'll turn it over to Alan to wrap up the session.
Yeah, just a couple of things to wrap up. Remember, our next club meeting is on November the 11th. That's Remembrance Day, of course. And the topic is Computers at War by Bob Walker, our very own Bob Walker, computer history guru. The next Library Tech Cafe won't be until the 23rd of November, but that's Lawrence giving scam, avoidance, and trust. And remember, for that, you have to register with the library, which you can do through our website link here. And finally, the next Q&A session will, of course, be next week, the 28th. So get all your Google Assistant and Android or Google Alexa topics and questions and points and useful tips together, and we'll have a session on that, I guess, as part of the next Q&A session. And we'll also have Tom's list of how to save space on your disk drives. Lots of different tips on that.
So that's and feel free to feed into that too if you have your favorite how to save disk space fireman. And even if you think it might be covered, it might not. So
let me copy my suggestions into the chat, and then people can add comments or add new stuff when they want.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, any other questions people have or other topics that you want to share? Our suggestion box is always open. Other than that, thanks very much for attending. Hope you found something of interest, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. See you next week.